From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we're talking about the urban forest that surrounds us. The Salt Lake Valley is home to hundreds of thousands of trees, though it wasn't always that way. We'll be speaking with Tony Glyatt, the city's urban forester, to learn about the history and ongoing management of this important resource.
For one, I think that irrigation of lawn is generally going to consume more water than it would be to sustain a good, healthy tree.
That conversation, your summary of the day's top local headlines, and an update from the World Cup coming up on The Rundown here on KCPW. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up a little bit later on the show, a conversation about the trees of Salt Lake City. First up, though, these headlines. A new poll suggests that Governor Gary Herbert's Healthy Utah plan has the backing of a majority of Utahns. In fact, given a choice between adopting the governor's plan and simply doing nothing, 88% of respondents were in favor of the plan. For more details, here's KCPW's Ryan Cunningham.
Governor Herbert has been bouncing between Salt Lake City and Washington, D.C., attempting to garner support for his Healthy Utah plan, a plan which was unveiled in late February. While Herbert works to convince federal and state officials to buy into his proposal, it appears Utah voters are already sold on it. A poll conducted by Dan Jones and Associates surveyed 623 registered Utah voters about their impressions and opinions of the Healthy Utah plan. The major takeaway, according to those who administered the poll, is that the majority of Utahns are supportive of Healthy Utah. But the poll also revealed that doing nothing or maintaining the status quo was an option that just about no one likes. Here's poll researcher Sven Wilson.
It's clear from this Healthy Utah poll that we're talking about today that this do nothing option is really unpopular, and that Democrats and Republicans kind of unite around that, even though when we do look at who supports which, it's the Democrats that are supporting Medicaid expansion.
In fact, Wilson says the way Democrats responded in the poll shows how Healthy Utah is a good compromise for those with conservative values.
They're coming somewhat reluctantly to the table on the Healthy Utah plan because I think that they're realists and realize that we have to get something that has broad political support. And so it's very crystal clear from these results that this isn't a plan that's appeasing the Democrats. You know, the Democrats are moving much further to adopt this Healthy Utah plan. It's a plan that's much more aligned with the conservative voter values. That's why conservatives and Republicans are the ones that show such high levels of support for this plan. The Democrats are much more reluctant.
But despite the broad consensus, Utahns appear to be short on information when it comes to Healthy Utah. Prior to being given a general explanation of how Healthy Utah would work, only 19% of respondents said they were familiar with the proposal, and only 6% said they were very familiar. However, 69% said they were interested in, quote, the issues of healthcare coverage and Medicaid expansion in Utah. And Riley Curtis of the Utah Health Policy Project thinks educating Utahns about Healthy Utah will only bolster support for the plan.
You know, there was some description that went into explaining what the different components of the Healthy Utah plan were. And I think that, you know, as you look through the poll results, you see that there was more support after they realized, yes, there is some skin in the game. People have to pay more if they make a little bit more, you know, up to a certain amount, that there's components that offer more flexibility, also work requirements.
And Curtis points out that getting support for any plan, be it Healthy Utah or Medicaid expansion, is vital, given how many people would benefit.
We work with Utahns every day who come into our office seeking help for health insurance. How do I apply? How do I get access? And then it's really the worst part of our, you know, of UHPP's job is to sit down and look someone in the eye and tell them, I'm sorry, there's no options available for you. And so I think at this point, a lot of them just want help. This is a way to get them what they need.
Public support or not, it remains to be seen whether the federal government will give Herbert's Healthy Utah plan the green light. There's also no indication that the Utah legislature has any interest in calling a special session to approve the plan. Previously, the governor has stated that he wants to resolve the matter by the end of the summer. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
The social services arm of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints says it will no longer operate a full-service adoption agency, but will shift resources toward adoption-related counseling. Officials with LDS Family Services made the announcement Tuesday, saying the change would provide would-be parents with more opportunities to adopt. David McConkie, who manages the organization's services for children, tells the Salt Lake Tribune that the traditional adoption agency model wasn't working for LDS Family Services. He said fewer women are putting their children up for adoption these days, likely because the stigma of being an unwed mother has subsided. Family Services has been placing 200 to 300 children per year, down from a peak of 665 in 2002. Officials tell KSL that the decision isn't driven by pressure to facilitate adoptions for same-sex couples. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. This is The Rundown. We'll be right back. With a foot, a head, and a whole lot of grit, the United States men's soccer team claimed victory over Ghana on Monday. So what does that mean for them moving forward in the World Cup? KCBW's Ryan Cunningham and Real Salt Lake blogger Matt Montgomery talk about the U.S. triumph and other goings-on in today's Daily World Cup Update.
Matt Montgomery, welcome back for Day 6 of the World Cup Update. Obviously, we had a big day yesterday for USA fans. USA defeated Ghana 2-1. What were your impressions of that game?
It's easily the most exciting game we've played since beating Portugal, some time ago. We've lost to Ghana twice, and finally to overcome that, and in such dramatic fashion with a goal in the first minute and then a goal in the 86th minute. Like, you can't really expect those moments, but they're just so exciting when they come.
Explain to people who don't exactly understand how group play works, like, how important was it for the United States to win that game, and what position does that put them in?
Yeah, it puts us in the second position in the group right now, which is fantastic because we're ahead of Portugal, we're ahead of Ghana, and we're behind Germany just on goal difference. So it puts us in kind of the driver's seat. If we beat Portugal, we qualify for the group. And that's really big for the United States right now. If we want to make it out of the group, we have to get quality results like this.
How do you like the U.S.'s chances against Portugal?
Yeah, I'm really excited for that because it's a beatable team, and it's probably the most beatable they've been in a while for us, maybe since we last beat them.
Today we've had two matches so far. What were those two?
We had Belgium defeat Algeria 2-1 with a little late drama in that one. And then the more local match of the groups, we've got Brazil-Mexico. That finished 0-0 after just a fantastic showing by Guillermo Ochoa, the Mexican goalkeeper. So that's the second 0-0 draw we've had in the whole group stage so far, but that was by far just one of the more exciting games of the World Cup so far, too. So
it was an incredibly exciting game. In fact, some of us in the office were maybe possibly watching a little bit of it and getting excited over it.
Yeah, it was good. Like, that sort of attacking play combined with good defensive play and great goalkeeping, it's a great recipe.
Russia and South Korea are playing right now. Who's playing tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow we've got Australia and Netherlands. And after the Netherlands' 5-1 win over Spain, this one will be really interesting to watch. We've got Spain and Chile, who will be, Spain obviously looking for a little bit of redemption after losing 5-1 to the Netherlands. And Cameroon and Croatia, it'll be kind of the match that puts either Brazil or Mexico in the driving seat moving forward in their group.
Okay, well, Matt, thanks so much for stopping by, and we'll see you again tomorrow.
Thanks for having me.
Again, that was KCPW's Ryan Cunningham with blogger Matt Montgomery, who writes about Real Salt Lake at rslsoapbox.com. You can also follow Matt's Twitter handle, @thecrossbarRSL. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. Today on The Rundown, we live amid a forest that we sometimes take for granted. Trees that have been planted through the generations now cover the Salt Lake Valley and provide shade, mitigate air pollution, can help save energy, reduce erosion, provide habitat for wildlife, and in general make our community more livable. Today we're speaking with Salt Lake City's urban forester Tony Goliat to learn more about the management of the trees in the city, to hear a little bit about the history of this work, and to understand what it takes to maintain a healthy urban forest. Tony Goliat, thanks very much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So I know that you're not originally from here. You were an urban forester in Illinois before moving out here. Am I right about that?
That's correct. Yeah, I spent 14 years doing the same type of work for a village and then just prior to here for the city of Park Ridge, which is a near north suburb of Chicago.
All right. Well, welcome to the area. How long have you been here?
Now I've been here about 5 weeks.
Wonderful. Welcome to Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. So if you're able, I thought we might start by addressing kind of the history. This is funny for somebody who's new to the Valley, but the history of trees here in Salt Lake City in the Valley. Folklore has it that when the Mormon pioneers arrived, there weren't any trees out there. Is that really the case?
Well, the way I understand it, not exactly. There were trees along streams and creeks where water was more readily available, but in large part, the valley was void of any real forests.
Okay. So not so much forest, but kind of sparse populations of trees around waterways here in the valley. And what would those kinds of trees, those species have been that were here originally?
Well, we had cottonwood, which we still see plenty of around here today. Things like box elder and some willows grew here. And then as you get up further in the foothills in the mountains, you would see things like Rocky Mountain maple and big tooth maple, gamble oak, things like that. And then, of course, some evergreen trees as well, some pines and spruce.
Here's an obvious question, but one that I always kind of wonder about. Are any of those pre-pioneer trees left individuals that are still alive, do you know?
I do not know of any. I think that it's possible that there may be some that exist, especially, again, more in the foothill mountain regions than in the valley.
Where not as much maybe cutting for timber would have happened.
Exactly.
Through the generations, we've grown this forest up around us, as I said in the introduction. How many trees, roughly, if you can estimate, are there in Salt Lake City or the Salt Lake Valley?
Well, on public property, we estimate that there are about 90,000 park strip or street trees, and then probably another 90,000 in other public spaces. That's parks and open spaces. So with the trees that are on private property throughout the city, you're probably looking at over 200,000 trees.
Well, when we talk about the trees that are in the city, both in public land and on private land, I guess some of it people have been planting, and so they'll be specific and not necessarily native trees. But what kinds of trees are there, or how many different species of trees are there in this urban forest of ours?
Our estimates are that there are over 200 different species of trees here and about 70 different genuses. So we have a very diverse list of trees that exist here in the valley, all planted by people.
One of the things that we've read is that the city's trees are kind of reaching, or that many of the city's trees, I guess, are reaching their lifespan, right around this time now. Is that true? And if so, what does it mean for the work that you do?
Well, in some areas of the city, that is true, but it's also something that's not uncommon for urban forests. Trees do have a natural lifespan for the area or the location that they're planted. And in urban forests, oftentimes we plant a lot of trees all at once. So they age together, and when it comes time, they start to decline together. Now, what does that mean for our urban forestry program here in the city? I think it presents some challenges, and it also presents opportunities. Certainly, the challenge will be to make sure that we continue to replace the forests that we're losing here so that we can get the benefits out of them. And from an opportunity standpoint, it gives us an opportunity to maybe right some wrongs in terms of mistakes that were made with certain trees in the past, and also just continue to try to optimize the benefits that we can get through smart planting and management.
You know, you talk about some of the mistakes that may have been made in the past. I'm wondering, when you're talking about those mistakes, if they are specifically types of trees planted, or is it where they're planted, or maybe both?
It certainly is a combination of both, and mistakes probably isn't the best word to describe those situations, because the way I see it, if we got a good long full life out of a tree in an urban landscape, it's hard to call that a mistake. But I think that there are opportunities to maybe get more out of the trees that we're planting, and we can do that by choosing the species that are most suited to the locations, the specific locations that are available. For example, planting a tree that has the potential to get extremely large in an extremely limited space or park strip, oftentimes we can come up with a better solution than that.
That would present problems for infrastructure and
certainly, and also problems for the tree as well.
You know, another issue you may have to tackle in addition to the aging out of these tree populations is the emerald ash borer, which is an invasive species of beetle. It's highly destructive to ash trees, and I'm wondering if it's having an impact here yet, and do we know how to deal with it generally? It's a lot of questions at once.
Oh, but they're good ones. Is emerald ash borer here yet? The short answer is no, but the longer answer is not that we know of. The furthest west that the insect has made it officially is Boulder, Colorado. That is significant because that means that it did cross the Great Plains and is now within a worrisome distance to the Wasatch Front. Coming from Chicago area, I'm very familiar with emerald ash borer and the impacts that it has, but also familiar with the strategies and resources available for dealing with the insect. How is it affecting us right now? It's affecting us in so much that we're probably going to drastically reduce, if not put a hold entirely on planting of ash tree species. It's a heavily used tree in this area as well as across the country because it performs well in tough urban environments. However, once we get a handle on exactly how many ash we have, I think it's probably going to be time to adjust our planting of that tree until we figure out what our long-term strategies are going to be.
What does the beetle actually do? I mean, is it gnawing away? Is it eating? How is it affecting these trees?
The insect kills the tree in its larval stage. So the beetle is the adult form of the insect, and that is a very small, metallic green, almost a speedboat-shaped insect is how many would describe it. And you'll virtually never see it. It's fast moving and it doesn't, it's not gregarious, so you don't see them in large numbers together. It's the larval stage, though, that is in the tree and boring, if you will, through the transport system of the tree where it transports water and nutrients from the roots up to the leaves and then, of course, the benefits of photosynthesis down to the rest of the tree. The beetle eats in that thin layer of cells that conduct that transport and basically suffocates the tree or dies of thirst or hunger, if you will. The problem with that is since it's a small insect and it's beneath the bark of the tree, many times we do not find it until the populations have risen to a point where they cannot be eradicated.
Mm. So we don't know that it's here yet, but it could be here yet. Do we expect that it's kind of bound to get here at some point?
With it in the front of the Rockies now, I think that it's much more likely than it was, last year before they realized that it had gotten to the Rockies. So.
Okay. This is a bit of a change of direction, but a question that often comes from residents about trees in their yards, you know, versus trees on city property. What is the city responsible for? And then what are city residents responsible for when it comes to managing trees? And I suppose I mean trimming trees here. Where is that line? I'm not myself a property owner, so I don't know.
That's a good question, and it's something that that the Urban Forestry Program does deal with on a weekly basis, if not daily. All public property trees, so park trees, open space trees, and certainly street trees or the trees in the park strips, are the property of the city and they're maintained by the city. So that includes planting, pruning, and removals when necessary. So there is an avenue for residents to participate in those activities, whether it be planting or pruning or in some cases removing public property trees. And that is a rather simple permitting process that runs through the Urban Forestry Program.
So you can get a permit to do the work yourself. If it's a tree that is, say, on a parking strip or is in a city-owned piece of property and you have a concern about it, you call the forestry department. So.
Absolutely, and we would encourage any residents with questions about public property trees or concerns to give us a call. What we do is when we get these calls, we generate a service request, and somebody from our program will go out there and inspect the tree. If it needs to be pruned, it'll be pruned. If it needs to be removed, it'll be removed. And if you have an available planting spot, we can get you on a list for a new tree.
A question that brings up for me is that I know that there are some arborists out there who are concerned that untrained landscapers and tree cutters are maybe doing damage to trees. There are some other states and communities that have certification requirements when it comes to trimming trees, to pruning trees. Is cutting by untrained professionals something that concerns you? And do you have any advice for people when it comes to hiring tree cutters for the trees that actually are in their yards?
Yes, it is a concern, in so much that it would be unfortunate for someone who maybe didn't know what they were doing to end up doing irreparable damage to any tree. As far as recommendations are concerned, I think that one of the beauties of living in this information age that we have here is that with a little bit of time spent at a computer, you can do a lot of good in terms of determining what the best option is for the work that you're looking to have done. So I always like to tell people that you want to make sure that whoever is doing the work is appropriately insured and has the licenses that are necessary. And then there's no substitute for making sure that you have a comfort level with whoever's going to be working on your property.
There's a practice or process of topping trees is the way that people describe it, which is just kind of cutting off arbitrarily sections of trees. And that's probably frowned on by people in your business.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that some trees can respond to the practice of topping, which would be cutting back to a stub as opposed to a viable lateral branch. And many trees will sprout out from those stubs and in a matter of a year or two look like nothing major happened. But the decay that is present there can continue to grow, and the sprouts that arise from those locations are not as structurally sound as a normal viable branch. So aside from excessive decay which enters the tree and an unsightliness, it's definitely a frowned upon practice.
Okay. How about more generally, what do citizens in the city need to do to keep our urban forest healthy? You know, we saw in recent years that there was a campaign to try and get people to plant their trees or to think about where you're planting your trees with maybe a preference, not so much on the parking strip, for example, but in your own yard because of, I think, water and also infrastructure. But, you know, I guess more generally, what are the sort of advice we can give to residents when it comes to protecting and maintaining these trees?
Well, I think one of the main areas of advice is that while we really only see the branches and the trunk of the tree, perhaps the most vulnerable portion of a tree from a long-term preservation point of view is the parts below ground, the root system. So when we are putting an addition on the home or modifying our hardscape with a new driveway or whatever the case may be, those types of activities can have a significant impact on the root system of the tree. And while those impacts may not be evident in the first couple of years after such activity, they can lead to decline or at least a reduced vigor of a tree. So always think about what's going on below ground. I like to tell people that you can kind of imagine that the part of a tree that exists below ground is equal in mass to the part that exists above ground. So that's a lot of area that needs to be protected, just like the above ground portions do. Aside from that, I think just encouraging residents to learn and know as much about the trees on their property as possible and the benefits that they provide is always helping put us in the right direction.
You know, a funny question that occurs to me is, where does the city get the trees that it ends up planting? I know that there have been drives in recent years by, for example, Salt Lake County, and I'm not so certain about the city, to plant, you know, a massive amount of trees in various places. Where do all those trees come from?
Well, most of them start out in Oregon. That's where many of the liner companies are, if you will. And those are the we call them liners. They're basically just single stems with no branches on them that are then sold to nurseries, throughout the West and then grown to a size and a form that is acceptable for municipal use. And that's when they come to us. But they do generally start in Oregon and Washington.
Okay. I'm wondering, Tony, about the use of water. I mean, we've had these trees for generations and, you know, we continue to plant, but is the planting of trees a big draw on our water resources? And is there a trade-off going on? You know, maybe you could talk to that.
Certainly, we all know that trees do need water to grow and to thrive. But I do think that there is a little bit of a misconception as to how that would be taxing our resource. For one, I think that
irrigation of lawn is generally going to consume more water than it would be to sustain a good, healthy tree. Of course, you water it a little bit differently than you would a tree. But one of the benefits that trees have is that they do conserve water. And then the water, when it is, I guess, released by the tree, it does have the effect of moderating temperatures in our urban areas, resulting in less energy consumption, and also the shade cast by a tree results in a lower need to water other landscapes as well, because they're not drying out as quickly. So in short, the benefits that trees provide far exceeds the resource needs that they have.
And then I just have two more questions for you. One is, are there certain species, I mean, other than ash at the moment, are there certain species that the city would rather not see planted or that you're, you know, staying away from because they're just not going to do very well here?
Well, that's kind of a hard question to answer. I think that I always am a little bit hesitant to rule out species because, you know, in the right spot, any species can be desirable. I mean, I can tell you that something like a tree of heaven and Siberian elm can be problematic for some of our natural areas because of their vigorous kind of spreading nature. But for the most part, I think all things, you know, have their place.
Okay. And then finally, this is a sort of funny question, but one that I'm always curious about. Where are the city's oldest trees and how can I see them?
Oh, I wish I knew where the official oldest tree was in the city. I'm not sure anyone knows for sure. But I would say that if you're looking in the area of the avenues and the cemetery, perhaps Liberty Park, you're going to find some of the oldest trees. I always say, and this applies to everywhere, not just Salt Lake City here, if you find the oldest houses, you're generally going to find the oldest trees, because just like what happened in this valley, when people go places and they settle down, trees usually are not far behind.
Great. Well, Tony Glyatt, we've run through our amount of time here, but I want to thank you for coming in and helping us think about the urban forest that we live in, and best of luck in the new position.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
And again, we've been speaking with Salt Lake City's urban forester, Tony Glyatt. You can find this conversation and all of our past interviews at our website, kcpw.org. This is The Rundown. We'll be right back. Thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. Additional help came from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. We're on the air each weekday at 5 p.m. here on KCPW, but you can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is at KCPWRundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.